I've
We're
made the
talking.
executive decision.
You've made an executive decision. Okay.
The last few weeks, I've sort of came in and gone, hey, we're going to talk about this thing, or hey, we're going to talk about something. I'm not going to tell you what it is, and then we're going to start. So,
So
John.
you're continuing that streak by doing exactly that again.
Well, no, because you have preparation in what we're talking about. I have no preparation apart from what you've just said. I'm doing a podcast.
Ta-da! Yeah, so I'm doing, well, I have been for the last week. I started a 30-day podcast because I talk a lot to my clients, but it's all very like with my clients. And a lot of them are now at a stage where they're like, okay, cool. I've got what I needed. I need to just get on with it now. So they've kind of stepped away for the holidays to be able to just knuckle down, get things done, and return in the new year. And so I'm like, oh, I actually, the first time in like nearly 6 months, maybe even a year as such, I actually have time to do stuff.
Don't jinx it.
Touch all the wood. Like it's been really nice. And I've been a little bit like fumbling on deciding what to do. And I'm like, well, what do I do? And I've recently appeared on a number of other people's podcasts and have just been having similar conversations. And I'm like, huh, what if I did these little, like, really short, sharp, because most of my podcasts are like, well, not as long as this. But because they're for business people and they're not really designed to be this long and really in-depth of stuff. But what if I did super short, under 5 minute podcasts that kind of touch on one specific thing? All kind of semi-scripted, no, properly scripted to be fair, all scripted so I know what I'm saying. So it's less rambly and more directed towards a certain goal or a certain thing. And I was like, yeah, let's do that. Because I like recording podcasts. I have a really good process of doing so, and I can do it really quickly because I've honed my Descript to be able to do it really quickly. I have a piece of software that I use that I know that I almost 100% trust. It's had some funny, weird moments, but doesn't all software. But I can get in and get out and record probably a week's worth of content in an hour or two, if I do the transcriptions and then create the social media posts as well.
So I had a thought while you're scripting these. I assume you're going to read them somewhat sort of like to the word, is that right?
No, never.
Okay. When you
It'll
said script, I
it'll
wasn't sure.
I will embellish a little bit because if I read verbatim, it's boring for me. So I will add little bits in and ad lib here and there, but primarily it will be me reading it.
So why is it boring when you read? This is something that I've never really understood with people that explain how, oh, I'm boring when I read, or I'm monotonous when I read, or I don't have emotions when I read. Reading other people's
Oh, I
work,
do have emotions. I just don't
okay.
enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, reading other people's work, I can grasp why that's difficult. But when you're writing it yourself, I've always been curious as to why, because why not write the way that you would speak?
I do.
So what makes it difficult?
I think what it is for me is I've been talking about this stuff for clients for so long now that it's not new for me, and I enjoy that like freshness of what I have to say. And so I've been saying all these stuff verbatim so much in client calls or when I'm having conversations on podcasts. So I'm like, yeah, I mean, this is the stuff that I'm saying is revolutionary, I'd say, for people not on the video, which I think is most of our audience. I made a face that I can't even describe of just like, why? Class is revolutionary, and it's like, okay, fine, then more people need to hear these ideas. If I don't want these ideas to be revolutionary, I want them to be the norm because they should be. In my opinion, they
By
should
now.
be the norm.
By
By now.
now, yeah. Yeah, I think an important caveat to put on there is innovation is always, oh yeah, this is the next thing, it needs to be the norm, and it obviously takes time, but a lot of the innovation that you're speaking of isn't innovation anymore. It's like 20, 30 plus years old, and you're thinking, come on, world, catch up.
Exactly. And it shouldn't be revolutionary, and it shouldn't be shocking for people to start from them. It shouldn't be, but it is, and it's scary because we're heading into a new age, whatever it may be. Things are changing quite rapidly and quickly, and people are still stuck on information that is, I don't even can't even think how old now. You would know better than myself, but the
It depends
information
what
just
information you're talking about, but
business of literature.
considering coaching practices are like 50 to 60 years out of touch, and business is far behind that, no offense, business, I'm going to go like 70, 80, maybe even longer. Mainly because business in corporate psychology, and from what I've seen of the business research that I look at, it uses myths. It still uses like proven myths inside of its research, very similar to teacher education with the whole, hey, we are going to teach learning styles. No, that was debunked like 20 years ago. Stop using it. But business are the same thing with other myths and psychology and
That's a
misunderstand
pyramid.
misunderstandings slash oversimplifications of research.
Maslow's
But,
pyramid.
yep.
Maslow's pyramid. I just loved it. I knew that it was not made by Maslow, and then I went and looked at the original paper again, and I was like, "So what? Where have they pulled this from?" It is one freaking sentence where it's just like, if I was to put arbitrary numbers on it, I was like, "Wow!" So the entirety of how we view motivation in business and like getting people to buy things is done on a gross on something where you're just putting I'm just like, oh, that needs to change quickly.
Yeah, there's so many examples of that. I watched a video yesterday on YouTube, which was another one of those videos where they did no research. They oversimplified everything with what it is that we're saying, and then they made an argument slash claim about how to be more productive. In this case, they were using motivation, and I want to get your take on this. So I, for those unfamiliar, when I watch YouTube videos, instead of taking notes on them because they're pointless, because I don't use them in my notes because their videos are poor, the sources, most of them, I just put inside the comment section on YouTube thoughts while watching, and then bullet point. Most of the time, I bullet point questions that would be directed at the author of the video, creator of the video, for them to answer. And I managed to get a response from the creator of said
Oh,
video.
nice.
I
That is
think.
not, that does not happen.
No, I think it's because I watched the video as soon as it came out because I was just on YouTube at the time. I was like, oh yeah, I'll watch this. So I added a comment like 4 minutes after the 6 minute video was published because I watch it at times two speed. And I got a response. And they were talking about motivation and how to be more motivated, of course. And I can't remember exactly what they said, but they said something along the lines of, some people aren't motivated. I was like, okay, fine, but they do things because they need to. And I was like, okay. So my comment was, if they need to, so I like quoted whatever the need to bit was, isn't that motivation via fear? And the alongside loads of other questions and comments, basically critiques. And the creator came back with by saying, they associate motivation with emotional inspiration. That was their answer slash solution to most of my questions. So I was like, how are you explaining what motivation is? And then loads of other critiques about what they spoke about with motivation. And like motivation from fear is still motivation. It might not be the motivation you're talking about. So what they've done is basically said, oh, no, I'm not talking about that motivation. I'm talking about this motivation. And I'm like, what? So, yeah, emotional inspiration. Would you say that's the same as motivation? Look of disgust. audio listeners are like, what the?
I do not have words for that right now. I can't even, like, emotional inspiration.
What they're basically suggesting is if you're not inspired to do something, you're not motivated.
Oh, you mean like James Clear in Atomic Habits?
I wasn't going to go there, but...
So, everyone, I'm just so tired of that damn book. I see it everywhere and I'm just makes me rage. Because that is...
I think he has some good points in the book.
Oh, yeah. But they are... They're tiny. Like, they are golden minuscule nuggets in the rest of the book that is...
I think if you look at it from a Gen Pop view, like, forgetting what research is, forgetting what academics is, and forgetting what sources mean, it's quite good. Because it doesn't critique or synthesize a lot of its points. But the points it makes are valid. Like, I've said this a couple of times, like in our personal conversations, some of the content I watch and consume is like a first-year uni student. It's like, I read this paper and I like it, so I'm going to reference it and say this is cool. But they haven't synthesized with other research and they haven't critiqued with other research. They've just gone, oh, that's nice. Let's take that and use that, which is a first-year uni student. It's a, I'm going to steal your idea, which is not wrong. It's just very low quality when it comes to academic work, which is why I say if we ignore the sources, the references, the academic worky stuff, and take it from a Gen Pop perspective, it's good. Not great, good. But it's popular.
I think you're being very kind.
When you look at the takeaway points for the book, they are not that much different from the applications, practical applications you would get from an academic pushing it. But the nuances the academic or the researcher or practitioner that follows the research would give, the nuances is where the change happens. But you can't give a nuance in a Gen Pop book.
Why?
Because how do you give a nuance to all of the different cultures for one chapter? For example, one of the tips, I assume, is about environment, creating an environment. Well, depending on your level of poverty or lack of poverty will change what that environment is. So how many nuances do you put in there? Do you put in classes? Well, now you have a moral issue of how do you define classes? If you put in cultures from different countries, well, how do you define that sort of housing environment to that country? Again, moral issue. So all of the sample groups that you would add nuance to brings a moral issue with classifying those types of people, which is what practitioners are there to do. Practitioners are there to say, I'm working with you, just you. Whereas a book is going, I'm going to say all of this stuff. And it's down to the individual reader to interpret the stuff for something that's useful.
Which I think is not what has happened in... I mean, the productivity space worships that book as if it's gospel.
It's because it's a Gen Pop book and it does a really good job of being a Gen Pop book. Yeah, you can hate the system, but it's right, the system works. And when you
I know,
it...
and I'm just like,
That's where the quality of interpretation comes down to the individual perceiving the information. Actually, this relates to a conversation I had with Aiden, one of the listeners. So they booked a call with me on the website, and they wanted to talk about, well, ecological psychology, ecological dynamics, and some of the research that I do, how I do the research. And we spoke about interpretation and perception of information and how the individual user will change their interpretation depending on their preconceived notions. And I think that right there is why science communication is extremely important when it comes to just general sharing of information, which is, I mean, that's a massive problem for information sharing just in general, not just in the productivity space of habits.
I've seen you in the last week just go, where's your sources, where's this, like, come on, try, give me something to go by. Don't just sprout stuff for the sake of looking of social clout, because that's what it is to get social clout, to get people to pay attention to you, except it's no longer working in the same way that it used to.
I think it is working, but you have to up your game, in quote marks. So what that has ended up being is they make even wilder claims, and they've gone very sort of news media clickbaity with what it is that they're saying, and they have even less evidence, like less than zero. We're talking negative evidence sometimes for the claims that they're making. What is negative evidence, you may ask? It's where there is more evidence supporting the opposite of what it is that you're claiming. And yes, that is stupid. Yes, that is naive. And I'm going to say it because I firmly believe that the flat earth people are like delusional. They just are. They have a I know delusion is perceived as a really bad term, but they have a delusion that the earth is flat, which we know for a fact. It is a priori knowledge that the earth is not flat. And those people that share that knowledge, there is negative knowledge about it. There is more evidence to support the opposite point of view. And people are sharing those negative facts online more because they want the clout. And because the no evidence isn't working, they're going to the negative facts because it's like, oh, drama. Oh, I just want to like go there with a wet fish and slap them around the face.
Notion is the best productivity app. That one annoyed me. I just
they have an argument to stand on, and I understand their argument, but their moral compass to me is skewed, because who are you trying to help by making that statement? The people that already use Notion, well, they obviously think it's the best app for them because they already use Notion. So who are you trying to help? The people that don't use Notion? Well, then you're not helping them. Now you're making a subjective claim about another tool that helps you and not them.
Which is pretty much the productivity space and PKM space.
Oh, yes. I was going to say, I've had people ask me about why I hate on Notion, and that is people's perception of the tweets that I make. I don't hate on Notion. I talk about Notion critically, but I don't hate on Notion. I don't say Notion is a bad app. I point out features that I don't like about Notion because I prefer using Obsidian, and then I give the use case as to why. I don't say Notion's bad, full stop. I say I don't like Notion's backlinking feature because Obsidian's feature is better because you can do XYZ with it. That's not me hating, that's me critiquing. There is a difference. And I don't support Obsidian. I support the features Obsidian holds. Yes, I do support the team as well, because the team's development is very good. I also hold my hand up and say I did a naughty thing as well with Obsidian. I called DM'd some of the people from Discord because I couldn't find any contact information for them. And I got told off because you're not meant to do that. So I'm going to say that now, like hold my hand up, say, yep, I was naughty. I shouldn't have done that. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I was trying to get in contact with people from Obsidian, and this is an assumption that I made, which I'm going to openly admit. I assumed people inside the Obsidian community, because they're always talking in the Obsidian community, are open to conversation. But they're not. Like, some people want to be really private. I don't personally understand the whole privacy thing, but I've got to respect what they do, the reasons that they have... they have their stuff hidden away. So yeah, that's an assumption I made that I shouldn't have made. So that's a reflective point for me and be like, hey, take a step back. So yeah, I just wanted to be open with that. I don't know where you want to take that, but.
Cool.
Nice.
I didn't really have anywhere to take that one. I was kind of like,
I think it's hard. I think it's hard to reflect from my experience, like, way back when, because I know you're in the reflection stage with reading the book. That's why I was like, thoughts?
Yeah, I'm a pretty private person. I don't like being DM'd. I'm not a fan of that myself, especially when it's just people. If someone wants to DM me, I want... I don't want to just be DM'd randomly. Like, I would prefer to be asked first publicly, like for me personally and what I do. And I get so many people, and I'm sure you do too, shoving apps like, I want you to try this. Come and try this. Okay, tell me why. Because just saying that you have a new app is not going to get me to try it. Just saying that you have a new application and it's really cool, well, you are inherently biased. Of course you think it's cool. You made it. Tell me why I should care. Why should I be interested? How will it benefit me? What will it do? And I think that's really important in terms of when you're DMing people. You probably did this anyway, but treating them like humans is so... And often, I'm having this at the moment with LinkedIn, for example. I'm kind of popping back into LinkedIn a little bit. And I just keep getting DM'd, immediately invited to book a call and chat about how they can help with my business. It's like, excuse me, how do you know I need help with my business? You have made a massive assumption about me that I need your help, that I'm inviting you, that I've connected with you because I need your help. Maybe check first before immediately assuming that I need help, because it's very like, whoa, just like, you want a conversation with me? I am golden for a conversation. Have a nice chat. Great. Amazing. But don't just assume that I want to do stuff or I want to like hire you, because there are human beings on the other end. And I think it's often we forget. Me too. I often forget. I don't DM people, but I do often forget.
Yeah, so when I get the DMs from lots of people, I'm open to all conversations, but the response that the person gets will mimic the message that they've sent. So if they send a shallow general message, I will respond with a shallow general message. if they put effort into sending a message, I will put effort into sending a message. When it comes to all the email spam that I get from apps being like, hey, look at my app, I delete them straight away. And my fail-safe delete them is, if you haven't looked at my website and you can see that you can book a free call with me for 30 minutes, if you haven't done that and you just emailed me, then it's a cold email and I don't care. I'm deleting it. I don't even care if the app's good. I'm deleting it because you haven't taken the time to look at my website, which is available everywhere, and look at the contact page and just book a call.
Yeah, and I think that's... And even if you don't have a place to book a call, I mean, I would find that really annoying personally. I think that's the difference between yourself and me. It's like, my time is so limited for me.
But obviously, the schedule link is booked on my time. So yeah. If I'm booked, it just doesn't show that open slot. And to be fair, the open slot is normally fully booked because I'm doing stuff.
Fully booked.
It's not booked through other people. It's I've gone, I'm working this time. I'm doing this thing right now on my calendar. So
that's something that came up. And I think it would be interesting to discuss.
Go for it.
I saw a statement saying that time blocking reduces cognitive load. And my brain went, no. From my experience, no. I have been doing, not time blocking, like batching. So I have been batching my content to make sure that no matter what happens, if I forget my password on my Mac that I've known for like, I don't know how many years, that really did happen this past week. I have stuff going out. It's what we do here. We go 1 week ahead so that we always have something on no matter what happens for one of us. And I'm like, my experience, and this is anecdotal, my own personal experience, is that actually batching doesn't reduce it. It kind of increases it for me during that time period and then doesn't afterwards. And of course, yeah, I'm intrigued at your thoughts on that from the science. But from my experience, no, it doesn't. It increases it for a temporary period of time while I'm doing that. And then I guess it reduces it, but also not, because then I do other things during that. Yeah.
So taking my emotional response out of it, for those of you watching the video, you'd have seen it.
No, I want the emotional response. It's more fun.
What the F?
Yeah, I know. I'm glad I wasn't the only one who... That was my emotional response. I was like, no!
So my first question is, the words that you used, are they the same words that was used in the message? Do you know?
Pretty much. It was. I will go and grab it again because I saved it and I was just not. I was upset because I was like, no, that doesn't sound right. That's not. No, sorry, but no.
Yeah.
So what it was three strategies to help reduce cognitive load, and one of them was batching.
Right. Okay. So what they're saying is, if you batch things together, it reduces cognitive load, which in theory is a good thing, because you want to reduce cognitive load in some areas.
Yes.
Right. Okay. My question to the individual that would have posted that is, first, what do they mean by cognitive load? Because are they talking about extraneous cognitive load or germane load, i.e. useful load, or intrinsic load? Because all three of those different types of load will be affected by different things. So saying it will reduce cognitive load isn't, like, you can't batch things and reduce cognitive load, because cognitive load is a general term for the total amount of load that you have.
Mm.
So you can't reduce cognitive load by doing one thing that addresses one element. You'd need to address everything else, because you can reduce the extraneous load, but that may increase the intrinsic load requirement for the task, which means you have a net balance. Like, the load, the cognitive load is the same, but you have less extraneous load. Yes, that may change the amount of mental effort you put towards doing the thing, because less extraneous load requires less mental effort as a general rule of thumb, but these are concepts, not facts, because we can't measure load. So batching could reduce some elements of cognitive load, yes, but it could also increase it.
Mm. Like, that's always been, for me, my experience when I do batch things is I, without knowing the terms properly, but with the assumptions that I'm making, I would assume it increases my extraneous load for a period of time, because it requires a little bit more effort and uses a little bit more energy, but it gets it out and done. If I'm wrong, please, I would be very open to...
Yeah, the batching doesn't really increase extraneous load. It doesn't really impact it that much for the performance of the task that you've batched. But what it does is mean the planning requires thinking. Because in order to batch, you need to plan. And in order to plan, you need to think, which requires cognitive load. So it means what you're doing essentially is offloading the load that you would perform whilst performing the task. Why you're doing it then, I don't know anyway, to another time of the day. So you're not reducing cognitive load, you're moving it elsewhere, which is fine, it works, I batch things, but it doesn't mean you're reducing it, it just means you're moving it. So the terms that they're using are oversimplifications, which is why I was like, what the F? You're oversimplifying an extremely complex term that hasn't been scientifically proven to be accurate yet. Like, I'm just going to put that out there. There's no way to prove cognitive load exists, because we can't measure it. We are measuring subjective measures for...
Hence why I said subjective, because for me, I cannot batch under normal circumstances. Like, batching is so draining for me. And at the moment, my focus is 100% on the podcast, which means I can. The environment has allowed these constraints and affordances to occur. Yay! So I'm able to do it. Under normal circumstances, I cannot batch for shit. I will literally burn out like that incredibly quickly.
But the thing with batching, which is what I've said about time blocking or time journaling or bullet journaling or whatever fun buzzword you want to dump in there, the thing with it is, once you've done it, it doesn't mean it stays the same. Like, you could batch things for the next quarter. Yes, I'm going to do this at this time, this at this time. Well, the next day life happens and now your batching is out the window, and all that mental effort, that cognitive load that you've moved elsewhere, you can dump it in the bin because in sport, you've got injured. All of that periodization planning goes out the window. Or inside of business, a client falls off or a client gets unwell or they decide to change. All that planning now goes out the window. So you've now actually spent more cognitive load doing stuff that you didn't need to do. I'm not saying batching is bad. I'm just saying that is a risk when you plan for long periods of time, which is why goal setting is very difficult to maintain inside of businesses because goals rely on batching or planning ahead of time, which is why inside of Elite Performance, the SMART goal acronym is not that useful. They use open goals with SMART elements.
Let's be honest, SMART goals are not really useful whatsoever.
I disagree. They are useful for a really small minority of elite performers.
Please, I am genuinely really intrigued.
So when you give elite performers open goals, there is less of a direction because they already have mastery orientation and a lot of the skills that they're looking to develop.
Okay.
So open goals are more beneficial to most people because it's the bottom of the pyramid if you're talking about performance. When you get right to the top of the pyramid, deliberate practice requires measurable, achievable, time-bound elements inside of practice. So the SMART thing, because it's smarter, smartest, smarter, because there's like three R's, there's so many different abbreviations for it, it's stupid. But the general idea of having something measurable, achievable, specific, built in some sort of time, you can encompass those things inside of good practice. I put good in quote marks because good is obviously subjective, but practice that's going to be beneficial to elite performers requires those elements inside of practice. So you could argue you would use SMART goals for a practice. But the stereotypical view of how SMART goals are applied in practice, no, not so much. But again, this is me using my understanding of the research to make something that I disagree with apply in a specific context, which is why I don't say this is bad. I say this is bad in this scenario, this context, this environment, but could be used there.
Yeah, this is something that I'm working with because I has opinions and a lot of them, as we all do. But a lot of what I'm trying to do now is ensure that my language is not necessarily neutral, but also like this, there are no real hard facts in the kind of topics that we talk about because it's all most of it is theoretical. See the language shifting. Like not all or less or none. It's all theoretical. So there is something in.
I would change that slightly.
Yes.
Most. As soon as you say all, there's a definite. All is a binary.
Most. Yeah. Most things are theoretical because they are, and there is no one answer, which is why I find my work fun, because there isn't a single answer. That's what I love most, and reducing it down to binaries is boring for me, at least, anyway, in my context.
Could you expand on boring? I did this with Aiden. I'm going to call him out a little bit, but I did this with Aiden. I poked him and he was like, I don't know. And he reflected and sort of reflected, active reflection, and said, I don't think I've been challenged like that before. And obviously it's what I do in this conversation quite frequently.
I'm used to this. So I'm like, all right, boring. There's nothing new for me. I don't see anything that captures my attention, that spikes my interest, that gets me to go, ooh, that gets me to think. It doesn't really challenge me. When I say it's boring, I don't feel challenged. I don't really feel motivated, which is not quite the word I want, but I don't have the language to use yet. but so motivated is the best one I can. There's just nothing that hooks me in, that gets me interested. I like things to be changeable because that's the way that my brain kind of operates most of the time. It's always thinking and moving in multiple different ways in every single angle and direction. But when I'm left with a, like, there's either a right or a wrong answer, it's just like, but is there? and
I want to ask a reflective question for you then. It's not challenging. Yeah, that's the summary. Yeah, boring yeah. is not challenging. So a binary is not challenging your thought processes, right? Mm-hmm. But doesn't it being binary make you question why it's binary?
Yes.
So you're following your curiosity because of the binary elements of... I see you're like, because if it wasn't binary and there was a context-specific example, would you go and explore it as much? Would you be as emotionally motivated to explore the answer that was given? We're thinking.
Yes, I am thinking. Yeah, I don't think... I'm not sure whether anything can be explained. Like, there is always additional context, in my view. So I don't think that... It seems a hypothetical. So for me, there will always be something for me to...
If we step back, like, 2 months in our heads and we talk about the neurodivergent word... Neurodivergent as a binary, when I first told you about it not being a binary, you were like, what? Confused, conflicted. You're like, well, it's us to be them. And that binary, when you recognized it was a binary, got you thinking and got you questioning. Do you think you questioned what that word meant once you recognized the binary, or once you while you accepted the binary? Like, when you were in it, did you question it as much?
As much, no.
Because that's what you were talking about. You're saying boring is challenging. So challenging is questioning. It's really exploring what's going on. So what I hear is your recognition of the binary answer is what triggers your curiosity, your emotional motivation to either disprove or prove or find nuance and context for the answer given. So I would challenge your explanation of it being boring as it being triggering. Like, to me, triggering to me is a more accurate word. I don't know whether it is totally accurate, but from the outside looking in, when you see a binary, you are triggered to either challenge, critique, synthesize, explore, do something about it, rather than go, okay, yeah, it's boring.
It is dependent on... Yeah, no, that is a good... I like that. And don't like that. Thanks.
Welcome to reflection. Yeah, welcome to reflection.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point, actually. I could play with that.
And for those listening, I would probably urge you to do the same thing with the words you choose to use. I do the same, which is why I'm very particular about the words I choose to use. I have a reason why I use them, which is why when people... This is something like real world Danny, IRL Danny. People don't like arguing with me. They haven't done since like second year uni, because there is a reason for the words that I use. And when people try and pick my words apart, most of the time there is a reason for it. And then they go down a rabbit hole that I've already thought through, because I've used the words for a reason. And then they just get frustrated. And most of the time it ends up with them shouting at me about something. And I'm like, yeah, but... proof, science, evidence, rationale, and then they get frustrated. It's great fun on a football pitch, because football players notoriously are stupid. And when I say stupid, just not very good at building arguments for the points that they make. They just say stupid things. So you can just make a comment and then they end up shouting at you and you're like, haha, you got frustrated. I'm fine. but yeah, so the point was, try and understand and grasp the words that you're choosing to use. It doesn't mean you need to have a large vocabulary. It just means that be specific about the words you're choosing to use. And I guess you could say a side effect of that is if you don't know something and you don't have the words for something, don't talk about it. Like, if you don't know, say, I don't know. Or if you're not sure, say, ask a question. And if you don't, this is actually what I was saying with Aiden. If you don't know enough about it, how can you, Aiden asked, how can you ask a question if you don't know? Well, in order to ask a question, you have to have preconceived notions about what's going on. So you're not questioning your meta ignorance, you're questioning the potential misconceptions you could be having with the words you choose to use. You're like, okay. So you do know stuff, it's just you don't think you know enough to
Yeah,
use the words
which
you
is
want to use.
often my, like, I suppose my trap that I get into is like, I don't know enough yet, so I just need to ask more questions and keep asking and keep asking, which is in some ways exceptionally amazing for reflective practice. But my question is, how do you avoid going into a spiral where all you're doing is just questioning everything and you don't really have an answer? Because a lot of the questions that you can ask don't really have an answer, and I'm already analyzing my own question here, so I'm just gonna put that down. Like my instant reaction to that is, well, there is an assumption of a binary there, is what my brain just went. And if there do I need a binary? Well, yeah, because then there's a preconceived notion I can go play with. So it's like, how do you? Because I would like reflective, being a reflective practitioner is pretty much a full-time job.
The recognition of a binary doesn't mean that the answer is a binary. It just means you've recognized something as a part of the process. This is part of ecological dynamics that gets very complicated with linguistics. So inside of the information processing and typical cognitive science perspectives, they say things are nouns. They say things are things. Like memory is a thing that you can do things with. A binary is a thing, like there is an answer to this question. There is a thing to it. Whereas most sociologists, psychologists, and philosophy, so individual, I was going to say
Philosophists.
philosophists then, but that's not a word. Philosophy, like individuals, they approach things as more verbs than nouns. It's sort of, they're doing words. They're processes that you go through. So a binary is something that you observe, and then the questions are processes you go through in order to potentially find answers. But it's a constant process. There's no end point because it's not, I have the answer. It's, I'm going through questioning.
So my question on that is, especially in like our industry and what we do, what I got from you earlier when talking about like, if you don't know something, don't talk about it. Nobody really knows anything.
Think about the words you've used.
Okay, good point.
What does nose mean? Epistemology. What does anything mean? Epistemology and philosophy. Everyone
But
knows everything that they are aware of. But everyone
so
also doesn't know everything they're unaware of. Is there more things you're unaware of than what you're aware of? Obviously.
how do you measure that?
Why?
Why do you measure that? Is that what you're asking?
Why do you need to measure it? Why do you need to put a thing on it? Why do you need to say, I know more than this person?
It's more of an I know enough.
What is enough?
Exactly, that is the question I am asking or bringing to the table. How do you know when it's enough? In terms of actual commu like marketing and all of the businessy stuff and the conversations that we are having, how do you know when it's enough to say something?
When I said what is enough is a noun. Enough is a thing. A thing is measurable. How can you measure enough? You can't, because it's knowledge. So why are we trying to measure enough? Why are we even using enough?
So what do we use instead?
It's a process. It's a process we go through. We are going through the process of developing mastery orientation, working through our own knowledge base, because if you go with enough, there is a line that has to be drawn somewhere.
That's true.
Who draws the line? Who decides where the line's drawn? Who moves the line? Is the line solid or fuzzy? This is sociology. Why do we even need a line in the first place? I don't expect anyone to have an answer to that.
Yeah, if you have answers to that, that'd be great. Cheers.
Yeah, this is sociology.
If you have an answer, is it really an answer? Because there's a line.
Exactly.
Which is true. Yeah, it's a really interesting conversation because there is that ethical responsibility. Like, we've been speaking about it in the past in episodes of, like, having your research, backing your research up, like, having research, but also there is the lived experience and how do you...
But what is
I suppose
that?
It is just being really clear. Like, this is my lived experience. This is the research saying this. I don't agree with this because of this lived experience, but this is what the science says. That's the kind of conversation.
That is sociology in a nutshell. So when it comes down to binaries and finding answers and being knowledgeable enough, it's the context you are in as an individual at that point in time, in space, if we're going to bring time into it. Like, you are right there, wherever there is for you. Someone else will be different. It's impossible to be on the same path. It's just impossible because we all have different experiences. So why are you trying to measure enough in comparison to someone else if someone else started from a different place? Like, on a 100-meter track, you wouldn't say I'm closer to the finish line if someone else is closer than you, but they started closer than you. They start at the 90-meter mark, you start at the 10-meter mark. Well, you've got further to go, but you started and you finished, in theory, doing the same race.
Fascinating. I love these conversations.
this is why when putting content just in general online and talking about things, if you're not cognizant or at least aware, even subconsciously, however you want to define that, I'm not going to go into consciousness because that's extremely complicated. But even unconsciously, if you're aware that there is something that you don't quite agree with, then it means there's a process to go through. Does it mean you have to go through that process? That's another question.
Yeah.
That's another question. And this is where questions will keep going. You won't find answers to all the questions. That's the whole point, because as we said, knowledge, there is more that you don't know than you do know. But even the stuff that you do know, you can change, because knowledge isn't finite. It's not I have this knowledge now, I don't need to change, evolve, do anything with it. Because knowledge, depending on your definition, depending on the epistemological approach that you take, will look differently to different people. So it might just be I've experienced that, and I've experienced that, and I'm going to take this conclusion in this context and do this thing, i.e. act like this, because of that experience. Does that mean I'm right? No. Does it mean I'm wrong? No. It just means I'm doing the thing. When I add objective, measurable nouns, things to it, now I can make a comparison and say, yes, I was right. No, I wasn't right. But it requires a thing for something to be comparable.
And there rarely are things.
Well, we make them up. They're called social constructs.
Doesn't that mean they're not real?
Yeah. Don't get me started.
I did. I poked the bear. And it's really interesting because a lot of things that I'm doing in my business is shifting to use the language of neurodiverse. I'm choosing neurodiverse rather than neurodivergent, which is probably semantical. But to me, there is a difference. Divergent is away from the norm, which assumes that there is a norm, which I do not believe there is a norm. Neurodiverse is a diverse range. And that feels not quite enough, but in terms of the marketing and how I market my work, that is where I've kind of got to of like, okay, I am comfortable with that in the knowledge that there is more depth to what I have to say. But one thing that I am attempting to strike from my language and the things that I'm saying is the neurotypical thing. Because every time I see that, I'm like, yeah, but it's an us v them thing, which I was in that us v them thing. And that has been a reflection for me of like, how do you neurotypicals do it? We don't. You don't.
I'm going to argue for the binary for a second, just to play devil's advocate.
Right? Oh, binaries are easier.
Yeah, I'm going to argue for it with an argument that follows your train of thought, because obviously it's my train of thought. It's an argument that I've gone through myself. So when you say there's no norm, are you adding an objective noun, a thing, to what norm is? Do you have a figure in your head of that is normal?
No.
So when you say norm, is it a type of person, or is it a group of people, or a group of behaviors?
It's probably a group of behaviors.
So are there tendencies and behaviors?
Damn it. Yes.
So there's going to be a normal distribution of behavioral tendencies.
Yes.
So the argument is that, well, there are neurotypicals because there are behaviors that people will typically lean towards.
Oh. So this is me basically freezing and buffering right now.
Your brain's, your hamster's run off the wheel and is like, yeah, no, I'm out.
No more today. No, that's really interesting. Because I think that's, because it was just another binary.
Yep.
I love it. It's so much fun.
But yeah, so the argument that the researchers on that side will say, well, it's not, there's a normal person, there's a normal distribution curve. And the normal distribution curve, the people inside that middle, mean, median, average, are the neurotypicals.
That bell curve.
Yeah.
Bell
yeah.
curve? It is called a bell curve, yeah.
Yeah, normal distribution. Yeah,
yeah.
Bell curve. But yeah, people inside that middle are the neurotypicals. Those people on the right or left of the bell curve are the not neurotypicals, whatever you want to call them. My question then, that may help you wrap your head around this, is how many bell curves are there?
Oh, bugger. There's a lot of them.
Because there's different behaviors, aren't there?
Mm.
There's different actions. And then there's different combinations, comorbidity of behaviors. Because when you add two behaviors together, it changes the action of the individual. So how many bell curves are there to make it normal? And do you have to be inside all of the normal bits of the bell curve? Or just some of them? How many is some? There's that line that people draw with the yeah. diagnosis. So visually in my head, I've got loads of bell curves, like one in front of the other, and you're in a different place on all of those different bell curves, which is all the metrics that they used for diagnosis. And that's the line that they draw. But that bell curve could be different depending on the sample size and the prevalence of the behavior in society anyway.
Yeah.
If you're saying distractions, you have this bell curve, well, more people are distracted more often now because of technology. So the bell curve has moved. Like, the distribution has moved because of the population. So it's not that the people that were in it now aren't in it, it's just there are more people that weren't in it that now are because of the environment that people are in. So more people are getting distracted. Does that mean more people should be diagnosed with a socially constructed disorder? I don't know. But we're constructing this disorder on norms, a variety of norms that are constantly shifting and changing, that people need to be in a certain amount of, at a certain degree, that's made up by people that draw a line somewhere, who knows where. And then you go, okay, How do you put a label on that?
And that's always that. I think that's quite the hard one of the things that I have been struggling with is figuring out, like, okay, so I work with neurodiverse individuals, but what does that look like? Well, that depends. And I know that some of the things that I teach, well, no, actually, most of the things that I teach can benefit people who are not attached to that label, because it's a perspective shift. And I'm being very careful with what I'm saying to make sure that I actually like what I'm saying. Like, it is a movement. There is a shift, because it's flipping the script on what is classed and what is said by the majority of people.
So what are you using as your classification of neurodiverse?
People who think differently. Which is why it's so beautifully
meta.
Yeah. It is, like, the first parts are the traditional, like, what is seen in society as neurodiverse. ADHD, autism. Because I have a formal diagnosis of autism, that is where I lead from. I mean, we don't even want to touch that.
Can I just be a pain and say which society?
I am giving evil stares of, like, don't start this now. I'll be leaving this call just like, I don't know anything.
Yeah, that's me, like, all the time in the day. But when you become comfortable with that, you can then challenge literally everything.
Do you become comfortable? How did you become comfortable with that?
Become comfortable with the unknown.
Hmm.
To me, I don't focus on knowing things, because I don't have a binary in that I have this thing now. I am on the journey to mastery orientation. What does that look like for me? It will change in the context, the environment, and the constraints that I add in measuring the comparables. So mastery orientation is a thing. It's a thing that you can get to. But in order to get to mastery orientation, you need to be able to compare some sort of metric to another person, or ideally a group of people. So in sport, mastery orientation is being able to perform skills better than the majority of other individuals. Inside of business or thinking or philosophy, psychology, you'll be comparing either your understanding, your depth of understanding around a topic, your ability to explain certain topics or explore certain topics, or the ability to practice the research and the things that you found out, practice them in a way that's meaningful to you in order for you to develop further forwards. So for me, I don't have a thing I'm getting to. I have goals, don't get me wrong. I have targets that I would like to achieve that are measurable. But when I'm thinking, I'm in a process of ongoing mastery development in a variety of areas. That's how I perceive it. But that is very difficult to get to. It took me like 2 years to actually get comfortable with that, because you're constantly, what I end up doing is constantly going, well, no, I'm wrong. I don't know anything. I'm wrong. I don't know anything. I'm stupid. I'm an idiot, because there are so many things that I recognize that I didn't know. And yes, I did fall into like some really bad mental health issues because of it. And I think whether it's a constraint or an affordance inside the educational system, but it's something a lot of students recognize early. And I think that's one of the contributing factors to the amount of mental health issues with students, is they are, at university anyway, they become very cognizant of how much they don't know, and they get worried about it. And mental health support is directed at helping mental health issues, rather than the individual's philosophy of lack of understanding, because that's where most mental health, in my eyes, comes from. It's their lack of understanding, which triggers worry about something, fear about something, that they're like, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what's happening with my job, with university, with my degree, what if I fail, etc. all comes from lack of knowledge or lack of depth of knowledge and the ability to cope with that.
And a lot of education is based on these binaries of like you either fail or succeed, and those those criteria are so abstract and not very like, yeah.
But this is why, like, my overall goal, my target, my whatever, whatever you want to call it, my why, as Simon Sinek would say, is to try and shift that. Like, shift that in the educational system. That is not a, oh, yeah, I'll do that in a month. No, that's like a lifetime achievement that I might get somewhere in it. Because the educational system builds the mental constraints that most people live in, which are the binaries that we've obviously challenged today quite a bit. But the educational system builds that because of the way the system is built. And it's not just the educational system, because when you look at what education is the transfer of knowledge. What is knowledge? Information, by rough definitions, which means everything inside of the world where humans communicate with other humans is part of the educational system. So the news, journalism, online content is all part of education, which means if we have binaries in those communications, then we are making assumptions that people need to know or don't need to know those things, which add more binaries, which can add more stress because people don't know what they think they should know. And that is where I personally think the rise in this mental health issue comes from. Not because more anxiety is a thing or more depression is a thing or more XYZ is a thing. I think it's because there is more knowledge out there because of the internet, which means that there is more perception of information that people don't know. And it's a skill that you need to develop in dealing with the unknown and coping with the unknown and taking a philosophy that you don't know anything, to use your words. But you do. You know a lot. It's just the stuff that you don't know is more.
And that will is unlikely to change.
It's impossible to change. How would you change that? How would you know more? Yeah, exactly. Mm. Like, when you really ask that question, how would you... No, it's impossible. I'm quite certain that it is impossible because there are things that we don't know we don't know.
Fascinating.
People are trying to fight something that's impossible and then losing. Why do you think they're losing? Because it's impossible to win. So instead of trying to win... change the narrative. Don't try and find a noun, find a thing, find a binary that's impossible to find and look for something else. Or go through a process, a verb. Go through a verbed process of trying to achieve a noun that you have created that suits your needs.
Cool.
How we got here, I don't know.
I don't know. This is what happens when we start talking.
Fascinating conversation.
It is. I love these conversations. They're good fun. They are good fun. And I think not a lot of these conversations are had publicly.
They are, but they are confined within language constraints most of the time, or philosophical constraints most of the time. Or they're in politics, but because they are in politics, they are either oversimplified or they've added brevity that makes comprehension complex. So, for example, Jordan Peterson talks about a lot of this stuff, but he speaks about it in a... He speaks about a lot of the processes in nouns to make it consumable to the individual. But in order... to add binaries, you have to add assumptions. By adding assumptions, you're now getting rid of that fluid element because you've added a noun to it in the politics. You've added an objective thing that people can agree or disagree with. And as soon as you do that, people would disagree. And it's an emotional trigger. So how do you talk about these complex topics in public? I don't know. Like, that is science communication. That is something that you need to do over time, over a long period of time, Which is why I would say it's not down to one person, to one thing, to one organization. It's everyone's tonality in society needs to shift towards processes rather than objectives. But it's hard to do that because a lot of people can't conceptualize what that means. How do you do it? I have no idea. If I did, I would suggest it. It's basically, putting it basically, it's getting everyone to be a sociologist. And that's just not going to happen. People don't care. So how do you try and navigate those fields? Get as many sociologists to speak from different perspectives as possible, which is what's happening in the news. But people have different levels of quality of depth.
Yeah.
Which again is the problems that we're struggling with. So it's a circle going round and round and round. We have a solution, but the solution is extremely challenging. I'm not going to say impossible because it might happen, but it's extremely challenging to do in the society we live in. I mean, when you go backwards in time, we had that.
What society?
Global society. I can say that, the global society we live in.
Yeah.
Everyone will have the same issue just to a different extent because of the constraints they've built and the cultures that they have. But when you go backwards in time and everyone was ignorant of what real education was because people didn't speak about the theoretical topics we talk about, it was only in academies, smaller groups of people. And they were speaking theoretically. You look at the Greeks, they were speaking theoretically. And that's where a lot of philosophy was born, I guess you could say. And even before the Greeks, these conversations were happening, and we know they were happening because of the drawings that we've seen and the way that humans have developed. But as more people engage in those conversations, you get more opinions, more views, and then you get stubborn views. And as soon as you have any sort of stubborn view, you add a binary. You add a binary, you add another stubborn view because you have to oppose the stubborn view to bring back to a fluid view, if we're going to call it that, using that terminology. And as time has gone on, more and more traditional stubborn views have been built. Nouns have been, or binaries have been added to research, and we can't suddenly just get rid of them, which is why academia is so complex.
Yeah.
Doing any sort of research is extremely complicated, which is why, I guess, a side comment here, I'm interested to do this research project that I'm going to be engaging in 2023 because I'll be doing research with other people.
So many questions that we probably can't talk about here.
Yeah. we could do that afterwards. But yeah, the ability to research with other people brings in a whole new scope of challenges for the exact reasons I've just expressed.
Yeah.
I feel like I've just said stuff and you've gone, yeah, I don't know what to say. And then I've said more stuff and you've gone, yeah, I don't know what to say. Don't say yeah.
I agree. No, it is really interesting to have conversations like this.
Conversations. Who else are you speaking that speaks in a similar way or challenges you in a similar way?
No one.
I was excited then. I was like, oh, let's go. What other sociologists are you speaking to?
Yeah, not many. Unfortunately, it's nice to have a conversation like this. I mean, I say conversations, meaning the multiple conversations that you and I have had and other, in some ways, other people as well, but not in the... It's not as interesting as this. It's very much like, oh, I sort of already knew that. Sorry, I already had that conclusion and that like direction. I'm a little bit further along now. I'm not there, although I get what you're saying. Yes, I think it's kind of like the neurodiversity topic that we've discussed. It's like, oh yeah, I was there like 3 months ago. Yeah. I know exactly where I'm like, yeah. I'm there. I've been there, but now I'm kind of on this thing. And often what happens is, I end up asking questions that people are like, oh, I don't know. That's why I
That's
like
my
being,
experience with here, is me asking
yeah, and that's
questions,
what
you're
I
like,
like. I like being on the other side of like asking these questions, and you're like, but what about this? Oh, it's nice to have these conversations because they're not.
Damn it, he's done it again.
Yeah, I enjoy them because it's nice to be challenged.
So, a question for you then. Where do you think I get my challenges from?
Probably yourself. A lot of it is your own reflection.
So, why can't you do that?
I do that.
Do-do.
I love that. Highly intellectual conversation. Toilet humor.
Yes, I'm still a child. Yes, I can speak with really big words that confuse people, but I can still laugh at doo-doo.
Yeah, it is something that I do. But sometimes it's nice to have like someone outside of my head. I do a lot of this in my head, but it's nice to have a different perspective. It's
Where else
more.
can you get those different perspectives from to help you challenge?
I suppose the internet.
So what I did with the motivation, I've done it multiple times, so the video is obviously a very surface level, but if I heard an argument from someone else, I would treat it as an argument. And an argument doesn't have to be a bad thing. In academia, an argument is how you have a conversation. So I treat it as an argument. Okay, you have made this claim. Do I agree with it? No.
Sorry, I need to come in here because I'm just like, yes, what you said about an argument not being bad, it's a conversation. I'm like, yes. Yes, I think about arguments, but my poor family and friends are just like, I'm not having an argument with you. Yes, we are, come on. This is fun, this is interesting. We have differing views, let's discuss.
My dad hates it. My dad hates it. My dad's like, oh, would you stop, like, me and my sister? We argue a lot because we differ a lot in views because we are from, like, she's 5 years younger than me. She's got a different perspective. And my dad's like, oh, would you stop arguing? I'm like, no. We'll just go somewhere else and finish it. But yeah, so what I try and do is I build an argument against a piece of content. So hypothetically, if I was to have a discussion with that person, I would have an argument to hold. And then what I then do is, because that person can't argue against me, is I play the role of that person as best I can. So I argue against myself, which is why when it comes to me justifying the rationales that I have for the words I choose to use, I know my arguments and I know the arguments that the other person would put against me, which is why a lot of the time I've already thought about the arguments that people are going to give. It's when they give an argument that I haven't thought of that I'm like, right, now I need to go down this route, which is the exciting part. And that's where the online content comes in, because I've built an argument for your side. What other argument do you have? And I'm at a point now where a lot of the online content I've already thought about and refuted the arguments that they have against me. I need a follow-up. And that's where I go to academia, because I'm like, okay, all this content on motivation is trash because the arguments are really poorly supported. I'm going to go to academia to find someone that knows what they're talking about. And that's where I'm at with a lot of the arguments. But online content is still the easiest place to start. And there's still arguments put online that aren't in academia because they're poor arguments. But just because they're poor arguments doesn't mean there isn't stock in them. It just means that they're not very fleshed out or evidenced yet. And the way academia goes, in 5 years' time, it'll probably become an argument in academia.
Cool.
So you're going to argue with yourself more.
Already do that anyway, just to argue with myself even more than I already do.
No, you don't. You meant to say yes or no, don't you? Have you not seen
it? My brain was just like, hang on a minute, do I? Oh, wait, you're making a joke. Yes, I do!
Oh, the Monty
Python. I argued with myself.
The Monty Python sketch, yeah.
I skipped you and went straight to arguing with myself. I'm like, ha, I don't need you to argue with anymore.
This is an argument. This.
That's not.
Oh, yeah, it's funny.
I love that sketch. It's such a funny sketch.
Most people are like, what the fuck are you talking about? Monty Python argument sketch. Just YouTube it. It's
YouTube it. It's so funny.
It's like a 5-minute sketch of them arguing but not arguing, and yeah, it's just funny. Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
I'm sorry, you've run out of time. No, I haven't. Sorry, so good. I love that sketch. Let's stop now with our obscure British references.
Yeah, Americans get some humor. Right. I'm sorry, but the American humor, I just don't understand the majority of it. It just goes over my head.
To be fair, I did an episode of a podcast. I can't remember what I was talking about because I've recorded so many. Yeah, I know, right?
You don't make videos like that.
Yeah, I know. I just find videos annoying. I can cut out stuff so much easier and it looks cleaner and I get way too fussy with
the B-roll. Just dump B-roll over the top.
Yeah, it's too much effort. But I have to find the right B-roll.
Why does it have to be right? Some of the videos I see, I'm like, why is there a B-roll of this random movie while you're talking about some serious thing? It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, so, that was it. Yes. Yes. The comfort zone conversation.
Oh, yeah.
There was a post on LinkedIn that I saw that was around pushing yourself outside your comfort zone and beyond the comfort zone. And once you go from the comfort zone, you go out to the fear zone. I'm looking at my transcription. And then you go to the learning zone. And then you go to the growth zone. And I was like, they were basically saying you need to be uncomfortable for a little bit and then you have to keep going because then there are no limits.
How many binaries do you want? Each zone is a line, which means the binary, you're either in it or out of it. Why can't you be in two different zones?
I know. And why can't those zones be flexible and adaptable?
Why do we need zones? Why do we need them?
Oh yeah, good question. Oh, so many thoughts. So many questions.
That's the question I default to first. It's part of metaphysics, which is an area of philosophy, get it right, where you basically say, yeah, but why do we need it? And then the reasons that you create for needing it oftentimes can be pulled apart. Philosophy Tube's done a video on, I think it's the social constructs video, where they discuss metaphysics and different properties of objects inside of environments. I think it's 5 minutes in where they go through it. I can't remember. Yeah. But this is what I try and do to remember where the sources are. I'm like, oh yeah, there's a reference. Where was it again? And then I'll check it. And like, oh yeah, I was right or I was wrong. But yeah, so Philosophy Tube's got a video, I think social constructs. Type it in, you'll probably find it.
I will.
It's a long video because I do video essays, which is the plan for the Danny Talks channel in 2023, if I have any time. So it won't be as well produced as that because, to start with, I can't put a light in front of me to get the right lighting because my eye hurts. First issue.
Yeah.
But
could you diffuse it more?
I'd have to diffuse it to the point where it doesn't really make much of a difference.
Could you have lights either side of you?
I have two screens.
Ah, yeah. I have one really stupid long screen, so...
All of my lighting comes from the window there, which is natural light, and then my two screens. I don't use any lights.
It's not badly lit, to be fair.
Exactly. I don't use any lights, and the reason is my eye. Like, if the reason I moved to dark mode is because the white light, it wasn't an issue, but because of the brightness of my screen, it's just the screen was brighter. So I had to turn down the brightness of my screen, which made some things, because they were just naturally less bright, unseeable. So like some of the videos where it's like dark scenes, it just looked like black on my screen because I turned the brightness down. So I was like, I just go dark mode. It's easier. So now I'm on the dark mode with proper brightnesses everywhere. But yeah, so when I do the Danny Talk stuff, I'll probably just dump B-roll over it and make it look good, and then just have me like, hi, I am a person, for like every like 2 seconds of like 2 minute video.
To be fair, that would be really easy to do.
Yep. I've already got a blueprint template video style from a couple of other creators. Obviously, I watch a lot of YouTube, so I know what style I want to go for. So yeah. James Janney is the one I'm looking at, if anyone's interested to look him up on YouTube. They've got like 15 videos, but like 1.5 million subs, and the videos are like video essays, so yeah, they're good.
Nice. Cool.
But I think it's time to call it there. Have a good day, everyone, and maybe we'll see you on Discord.
Yes. Bye.